Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:21 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 23rd. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So it's been a good news, bad news week. The good news is that more of the overvaluation in asset prices has been unwound. The bad news is that it's probably not over. And I thought I would kick off with the central bank rates because the Fed funds rate has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. We're up to 3.25%. The chances are it's going to be at 4% in November, a bit higher than that in January. But the more important point is that it's breaking the downtrend. And as we look at this commonality factor, so the Federal Reserve has been aggressively raising rates, and they've been doing it faster than most places. Now, the ECB is trying to catch up, but they're still at only 1.25% after the 75 basis point hike that we had this week. Bank of England is also raising rates. They raised them by 50 basis points this week, and that wasn't particularly well welcomed by the markets. They were hoping for 75 basis points. But it's also worth reminding ourselves that in 2008, the interest rate was around 6%. And we're still well shy of what's currently available from the Federal Reserve. Then the Swiss are, I believe they raised rates in here today, so it hasn't been updated yet, but that's just coming out of negative territory. Australia is raising rates. Now, one thing that we can very clearly identify is that rates are going up. They're not going down. And they're going up everywhere. In Canada, we're up to about 3.25%. And New Zealand, up to about 3%. But it's just thinking about the compression in rates that we've had over the course of the last decade. And all of these rates have gone from reasonably high levels down to record low levels. When rates go down, appetite for borrowing goes up. So then the pressure for repaying that debt doesn't matter, because if rates continue to go down, you can always refinance at a lower rate. But when rates go up, and not just go up, but stay up, well, then some of the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market start running into trouble, and something's going to break. I think that's the most important takeaway here, that when you have a very prolonged period of rates going down and massive appetite for debt instruments, and I think we'll spend at least some of this broadcast talking about where the concentration of that risk is, but we can be absolutely assured that there's been a significant concentration of interest in debt instruments. And we also know for sure, and the things that people were worried about before the pandemic was the rise of, or the proliferation, I should say, of the covenant light lending standards in the leveraged loan sector. And again, that wasn't problematic until rates have started to rise, but it's going to become problematic. And the more of these charts that we look at, now we can obviously look at Argentina, and they have rates of 11.5%. They should be way higher than that, so it's artificial. Now, in China, the base lending rate is still hovering around 4%. The discount rate's at 2%. So they still have this huge differential between the lending and deposit rates. But the reserve requirements at the banks have been coming down, but they're still around 11.25%. Singapore hasn't, I'm sorry, this has not updated. So I'm just going to skip past that. The Philippines is up now to about 4.25. Taiwan is just starting. Malaysia has been raising rates. India is just beginning to raise rates. Russia is sort of outside of the remit right now. South Africa is up to 7%. Brazil is at 13.75. Now they have raised rates faster than anyone. And it's looking increasingly likely that they have, in fact, got in control of their inflation problem. So they're anticipating that they're going to start cutting rates next year, and that they're anticipating that the inflation rate in Brazil is going to come down into the mid single digits at some point in January. So Brazil offers us an example of what has to be embraced in order to get in control of this inflation, and it is positive real interest rates. Now, of course, Brazil has historically had inflation problems, and they have had to go through significant periods of social distress and living standard compression in order to get in control of inflation. It's very much to be debated just how much appetite there is for that kind of sacrifice in much of the developed world. Sweden is also raising rates. So what we have here is a very clear commonality. Everywhere is raising rates. Some are raising rates much faster than others, but they're all raising rates. And this means that liquidity is becoming less available. It means that we've had this huge run-up in the dollar. So not only do we have the price of money becoming more expensive everywhere, but we also have availability of currency becoming an issue. So these are certainly important factors. And we're starting to see yields now on overnight yields on some of these currencies that are beginning to become really quite attractive. When, for example, you can get 8.5% in Mexico, or you can get 11% or 10.75% in Chile, then it is worth paying a lot of attention to the currency. So let's look at some of those currencies. Now, the dollar index has broken out this week, and the dollar is absolutely resurgent. So this is a profound change. We can also just bear in mind that this is a big move in the dollar, and it's certainly momentous. When, if you just look back at the Deutschmark instead of the euro, it's the dollar has just cruised through the big psychological two level, and it's trading stronger than parity against the euro. And in 2000, the weakest that the euro got to, or the Deutschmark got to, was about 2.3. But then we also had the phenomenally large bull market in the dollar from 1980 through to 1985. And this is a really quite impressive breakout from an exceptionally lengthy range. We obviously have a short-term overbought condition, but no evidence just yet that the Federal Reserve is going to waver. There has been a very clear question about, will the Federal Reserve have the appetite to continue to raise rates in an aggressive manner? And will they be able to continue doing it when unemployment begins to rise? But one thing that's, I think, especially important to pay attention to is that there is a significant lag between when interest rates rise and when the net effect starts to become evident in the economy. And They've really only been raising rates this year, and it can take anything from 6 months to 9 months before they become apparent in the market. So we're in September. It would probably suggest that it's from here on out that we're going to start to see the net effects of interest rate hikes on the economy. But then let's think about the pound. One thing that I think is interesting is that we had a 36% decline during the credit crisis in 2008, a 31% decline during the pullback after Brexit or into Brexit, ahead of the referendum and then immediately afterwards. And since the middle of 2021, the pound has done little but decline, and now it's broken down. So from that peak to a potential trough, we're accelerating towards parity. Now, the big question then is, what's going to happen next? The Truss government has just released a new budget, and she has actually followed through on her promises during the leadership battle. So she is cutting taxes. So they've shaved the national insurance hike, or they've cancelled the national insurance hike that was introduced by the last government. And they're cutting income taxes for wealthier individuals within the economy. Although I think it is worth highlighting that anyone making in excess of £50,000 falls into the top rate, or darn close to the top rate in the UK, which means that the bands are exceptionally tight. But realistically, that's a big tax cut for wealthier individuals. 1% cut for less wealthy individuals, people making in the bottom half of the income spectrum. Then significant other changes in terms of regulation. Those are much more important. Cutting taxes should help to boost consumption. But boosting consumption when inflation is running rampant isn't exactly sound policy. And more importantly, it's not exactly sticking to conservative ideals. And this is supposed to be a conservative government. But of course, this conservative government is very much beholden to the blue wave from the northern part of the country, who would have historically voted Labour. So the pound is deteriorating quickly. Now, deregulation is an urgent thing in the UK. We've had an interesting statistic over the course of the last month, and it's that the Indian economy is now larger than the UK's. One of the biggest bugbears that global investors have about India is how sclerotic the bureaucracy is. But what nobody really seems to talk about is that they inherited that bureaucratic system from the UK. And UK bureaucracy is something to behold. Then there is something that I've noticed, and this is going to be hard to hear, but I've lived in many different places in the world. I've lived in the UK, and I've lived in Australia, and I've lived in the USA. And something I'd never seen in my life before, but I saw it in the UK, was inside an office. There were people sitting at their desks with a clock counting down to quitting time. And these were people that were doing editing for editing software, making sure that pages fit on various platforms, made sure that everything looked nice on the website. But they were very much of the opinion that they weren't going to work more than they had to. Now, there's been all of this talk in the media in the UK about quiet quitting. And what that basically means is, in the USA, that people aren't willing to do the extra work. They're not willing to go the extra mile to complete the project. they're only going to do exactly what it says on their job description. But I've seen that in the UK for years already. So there's certainly a culture change has to happen. And the socialistic and anti-work phenomenon has to be addressed. Now, then, of course, there is the big question about how to fund the National Health Service when you have a rising number of elderly people, fewer immigrants, fewer younger people entering the workforce, and therefore lower tax receipts. Well, that's where the devaluation of the pound is going to come in. It's going to make the economy more competitive, but that doesn't happen immediately. And obviously, there's going to have to be a significant reorientation of the economy. And deregulation has to be central to that. Now, the Truss administration does appear to think that that's what they can achieve, and more power to them. And this is a very clear effort to devalue the currency. And unfortunately, the last two big devaluations did not result in a reform of the bureaucracy or a reform of regulation. But perhaps needs must will triumph on this occasion, so it might free up planning for more energy exploration and more onshore wind. But really, anything that can achieve energy independence. I think it's worth considering that the pound was a stable currency from 1990 through until about 2008. But it was on borrowed time when the UK stopped being an energy exporter. And it's probably not going to stabilize, much less get back to two to the dollar. Until it is yet again an energy exporter. And that's going to be a long road. Now, one thing that I think is especially important here is that we've had a secular bull market underway on Wall Street for the last 14 years. And that's been a phenomenal advance. So the Nasdaq was trading at give or take about 1,000 back in 2009, and it got up to nearly 17,000 in 2021. And you can see very clearly the pink line, which is the 1,000-day moving average. And I regard the 1,000-day moving average as the secular trend mean. And it's the point where if you're going to buy the dip, that's where you buy the dip. And buying the dip always works in a secular bull market. Now, it's worth considering what is it that were the motivating factors behind the secular bull market? Well, the first one was low interest rates. Interest rates went to zero and then they stayed there. Then we had 4G. So that was transformational for online companies. I think the example of streaming services is probably the most or the one that people will associate with easiest. So you had Mark Cuban basically invent the streaming model in the late 1990s. And broadcast.com was the biggest sale at the time when Yahoo bought it for billions, and it went nowhere. Enron was going to have a deal with Blockbuster Video for a streaming service and went bust immediately before it was launched, which was in the early 2000s. And Netflix started off with mailing DVDs to people. But it didn't start streaming until at least 2007, and it didn't really take off until about 2012. But it was around 2012 that fast internet really took off. And with it, streaming went crazy. So it was the evolution of 4G was the motivating characteristic behind online shopping, behind social media. And this was a, and for that matter, the growth of the cloud, increasing demand for handsets like the iPhone were all tied to that one theme. And it's been the driver behind this bull market. So you had low interest rates, lots of money, internet connectivity on a scale never previously available, the rise of the global middle class, where we have demographics on our side, still a rising number of young people entering the global economy, globalization, which gave all those people around the world a chance at a better standard of living. So when I wrote Crowd Money back in 2011 and 12, and it was published in 2013, those were the big factors. And then, of course, we had the evolution of shale and unconventional oil, which turned the USA from being the biggest importer in the world to being an exporter. Low energy prices, combined with low interest rates, combined with internet connectivity and a rising consumer base around the world were the four pillars of this phenomenally large bull market that took the Nasdaq from 1 to 17,000. So, interest rates are now rising. That's one of the four pillars under threat. And globalization is not nearly as reliable now as it was a decade ago. And Xi Jinping has been in power for a decade. So he has single-handedly killed off the inflation, or excuse me, the globalization theme. 4G is already in the price. And all of this talk about 5G, the so far at least, the difference that it makes is not noticeable. So that's not as powerful a tailwind as it was in the past. And now energy prices are higher than they were a decade ago. So we have two significant factors that are constricting liquidity. And then we have fewer consumers that can avail of new services. And this has been the big challenge for the large companies. When you already have 1 billion or 2 billion users, well then, where's the next 1 billion users going to come from? And do those 1 billion users have sufficient resources to be able to pay for your services? It's obviously why Netflix has got a very different price plan in India than it does in the rest of the world, for example. But in order to fuel that growth, to go out there and find that 1 billion people, well, you need access to liquidity. You need lots of cash. And then we have to just consider that in order to get that enthusiasm, you have to make big promises. And those big promises are that we're going to not just have electric vehicles, we've got those already, but they're going to be autonomous. They're going to drive themselves. There's going to be this revolution in artificial intelligence, and it's going to change the way we live our lives. And our world is going to be so much easier because we're not going to have to drive ourselves anywhere anymore, and it's going to be such an enormous productivity enhancer that at the price you're paying today is cheap. So that's one of the promises. Then you have another promise that big data is going to and the processing power that is coming to bear is not only going to be able to answer questions we have today, but it's going to answer questions we don't even know how to ask. And it's going to create productivity enhancing ways of doing things that are literally going to change the world. Now, the most important thing about big promises that accompany bull markets is that They do eventually come true, but they don't come true in nearly the time that people anticipate. And this is one of the big challenges for the cryptocurrency sector. Cryptocurrencies are making, are writing promises that they're going to have difficulty following through on. And most of those tokens are going to be worthless. And they will eventually come up with a use case. And decentralized finance is a really attractive process. But central to the cryptocurrency world is that it's not regulated. And this is, I think we have a very good example of that, Alibaba. So Alibaba created Ant Financial in China. So what Ant Financial does is it offers higher interest rates. We very briefly saw there that the deposit rate in China is only about 2% and the lending rate's 4%. So you're just not going to make the money that you need by putting your money on deposit. So Alibaba was able to offer higher interest rates, and then they paid the rate daily. So often saw kids or young people, they were so proud to show their Ant Financial app on their phone and watch and saying, "Look, my interest went up today." So that's a really attractive characteristic. It's also completely against the law. And the big banks are not allowed to offer a higher deposit rate. So Alibaba, because it was not a bank and it was sitting outside of the normal banking sector and in an unregulated gray space, was able to break the rules. And then it got very roundly rapped on the knuckles when they decided that they were going to try and stand up to regulation. And since then, Alibaba has come back from 300 to 80. And basically, what this is excising the Ant Financial valuation from the online shopping portion of the business. And this is probably also what's going to happen with cryptocurrencies, because what they're really doing is securitizing, but they don't have to really follow any of the securities laws, and they sit in the gray area outside of regulation. And when they are eventually regulated, well, then the vast majority are going to be completely worthless. So then this is obviously but then the survivors will probably be able to innovate and deliver on the decentralization and deliver on the smart contracts and all of those other promises that we don't really know what they're for yet. And this fractional ownership model is certainly something that appears to have legs. And we're not going to have a real reckoning on that until large numbers of people want to sell out of their shared interest in physical assets. One thing we've certainly seen is that when cryptocurrencies start to sell off, then the exchanges aren't capable of managing the orders. So Bitcoin's below 10, or excuse me, below 19,000. And has pretty much unwound the advance put in yesterday, but it's still a downtrend, and right at the lower side of the range. And when we look at all these other asset classes that are breaking downwards, it's unlikely that Bitcoin is going to retain relative strength for very long, because it's as much dependent on availability of liquidity as everything else. So then let's think about the kinds of things that have been holding up and are now starting to roll over. So there's been this very clear argument that oil prices were going to permanently stay around the $100 area, but they were down in a pretty dynamic manner in here today and at a new reaction low. So at Brent crude is down to $86, coming back into the upper side of that underlying range. The US government has said that they're going to start buying for the strategic reserve around $80, and it's understandable that they might be willing to support prices at a somewhat higher level for two reasons. The first is the fact that the USA is now an exporter, so it's in their interest to have a stable, somewhat higher price. And of course, the second one is that the Biden administration doesn't want prices to go down. They want people to buy electric vehicles. And that's not nearly as compelling when gasoline prices are $2. So they'd much rather have them somewhere around four. But if we're looking at global liquidity issues and global rates rising and central banks everywhere restricting access to liquidity, then buying for the strategic reserve in the USA isn't going to be enough to support prices. And there is the possibility now that what we're in fact looking at is at the beginning of a global recession. And it hasn't started yet, but assets are starting to price that in. Then let's think about copper. And everyone is really interested in the rollout of electric vehicles and thinking that it's absolutely inevitable that copper prices are going to multiply in value. And mining companies are saying, well, this is the best thing that's ever happened to us because all of these people that hate the idea of building new mines, but they want to see supply of copper double over the course of the next 10 years. So maybe they'll take away some of their resistance to building new mines. And of course, that's not going to happen. And the same people that want electric vehicles have absolutely no conception of what's required to double global mine capacity. And the reality is that nobody wants new copper mines. And nobody wants to really consider how long it takes to build a copper mine. And during the last big bull market from 2001 all the way up to 2008, there was really only one big copper mine came onto into production, and that was the Oyu Tolgoi mine in Mongolia. And then to ramp up production took another 5 years, and arguably it's not at full production yet. So when people talk about it taking 20 years to build a copper mine, it's not an exaggeration. You have to move a mountain of, and probably multiple mountains of material to get the copper that you want. So then it's unlikely that there's going to be enough copper to meet the demand. That doesn't mean this, we're not talking about semiconductors where you can just go off and build new factories. It doesn't mean then that price has to necessarily go up, because that's a circular argument. If they can't buy the copper at all, they just won't build the batteries. And that means that there'll have to be a change in the chemistry. Now, there are changes in the chemistry underway. And Tesla said this week that they have enough batteries to meet demand for the first time. Whereas what we're in fact seeing is a change in the battery chemistry. So in the USA, they're using the heavy nickel copper demand ones. And then in China, they're building more iron-based batteries, which have less fire risk, but then don't go as far either. And what it really suggests is that automotive companies have basically given up on the range question, and they're trying to keep costs down. They're trying to use less copper. The only way that there's going to be enough of copper around to support that particular trend is if demand in China evaporates, because China consumes 57% of all the copper in the world, and they process most of it as well. And the price was down an extra 12 cents in here today. It's encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. This is a bearish trend, and it could easily come back down to $2. Now, maybe then demand will explode higher because EVs will suddenly become economic. But there'll probably be a good number of bankruptcies in the unprofitable EV sector well before that happens. For example, Faraday Futures, they haven't sold a car yet, and the share price has gone from 8 to 76 cents over the course of the last 3 months. And there's plenty of these types of companies. I can't even remember the Karoo or Caribou or something like that. Another one of these EV companies, no, not even earnings. Forget about profits. They have no earnings, and had achieved these extraordinary valuations. And this is exactly what we see in bull markets, that there's money for everything. And a lot of that money goes to money heaven, because the projects that are invested in have no realizable potential to reach profitability before interest rates rise. And that time is now. So interest rates are rising. The big test for companies is, could they get to net positive cash flows before interest rates went up? That was the race. Now the race is over. And anyone who comes in after now is not going to survive. So when we look at these ARK Innovation type ETFs, then still trending downwards. This is the problem with something that goes from 60, 160 to 40. It's down 80%. And the problem is that this is a perfect example of what you see in every bull market or in every bear market. What's the definition of an asset that's down 90%? It's one that was down 80% and halved. So it's quite possible that the ARK Innovation ETF could go down to 20, which would be a halving from here. And who's to say that that's the end? Because some of these companies are going bust. I've been watching Tesla, and the share price is pulling back now from the $300 area, and we have a sequence of lower rally highs. Now, it was actually in positive territory in here today, but this does not look like a consistent trend. It was beautifully consistent from the low in 2019 to the peak around 400 at the end of the year, of the end of 2021. We had a sequence of ranges, one above the last. When we look at this on a log scale chart, which shows us the percentages, then we can very clearly see we had long-term ranges, one above the last. And each one of these ranges was still holding. Then we dropped below the $300 level, and the price is now at 275. So it has broken down, it has taken out the midpoint danger line, and now the it so th by technical definition, it is no longer a consistent trend. In which case, the risk of a significant decline from here is non-trivial. When we think about selling big ticket items like cars, being able to offer a very low interest rate is very attractive. And Tesla has been raising their prices. And the Model 3 started off as a $35,000 car. Now it's a $40,000 car, and that is before you add on a single extra. And a $40,000 car is fine to buy when interest rates are zero, and you don't really have to pay a high interest rate. But what happens when the interest rate on your car is 7%? Well, then your ability to buy that car deteriorates. This is, I think, one of the biggest challenges. Corporate profits are at an extraordinarily high level. So we haven't seen corporate profits decline yet, but the stock market is beginning to price that in. So if interest rates continue higher, then the knock-on effect of tightening liquidity is going to become progressively more of a headwind. We can also see that the 60-month moving average was particularly relevant in 2008 and in 2020. But it also means that corporate profits could come back by a third and still be in the region of that 5-year moving average. So this is a clear risk because the E in the PE has the potential to contract rather meaningfully. Then let's just think about some of the companies that people really like. Charlie Munger has been singing the praises of Costco for an awfully long time, but the share price certainly accelerated. It went from 300 to 600 in the space of little more than a year. Now it has head and shoulders characteristics, and it has broken the uptrend. We've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, a period of right-hand extension. So this looks like a completing top formation. Walmart is one of the biggest employers in America. They employ more than 2 million people. And it hasn't been the most consistent trend in the world, and it didn't accelerate. But we did have a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We did have a failed upside break. And now the share is pausing at the lower side of the overhead trading range. When companies like Walmart, which are consumer staples by definition, start to encounter resistance, then it becomes problematic. Then let's think about Apple, the largest technology company in the world. So again, this is another one that accelerated in a profound manner, going from 60 to 180. And then it has a sequence of lower rally highs and is rolling over once more. So we know that Apple is cyclical, and everybody experiences that because very few people buy a new phone until the battery starts losing charge, and that's a 3-year cycle. And there are lots of cyclical portions of the market. So the semiconductors index, it did spectacularly well in the late 1990s during the Y2K crisis. Everybody needed new tech now, and there was a huge investment cycle in new semiconductor manufacturing, and the semiconductors index went up in a really profound manner between 1998 and at the peak in 2000. It went from around 190 to 1375. But once all those factories were built, well, then why do you need to build more factories? And once you've built a factory, they're exceptionally expensive. So the only way you can pay for them is to run them at full capacity so that you're just pumping out semiconductors, pumping out memory, and you'll take whatever you can get for it. So prices crash. And we're seeing exactly the same thing now. Between 2016 and 2021, the semiconductor index went from 5 to 4,000, 500 to 4,000. And now we're down around 2,500. But every country in the world seems to be devoting tens of billions of dollars to building new fabs. That's China, South Korea, Taiwan, every country, major country in Europe and the USA want to build new production facilities. So companies like ASML, they're talking about, they have a 3-year pipeline for new machines. But are they going to be able to sell even one machine after that 3 years? That's one of the really significant factors. Now, when we think about the epicenter of risk, I think we have to spread the net rather wide, because it's always difficult to ascertain where the epicenter of risk is. At the moment, we have weak stock markets and surging bond yields. So the 60-40 portfolio isn't working. And more to the point, the risk parity strategy isn't working either. So this is very problematic. There's a lot of money that is devoted to the risk parity strategy. And more importantly than that, it's not supposed to lose money. And at just the ETF alone is down from 26 to 18 over this year and still going down. So, with tighter liquidity and clear efforts underway to try and get in control of inflation, something's going to break. And we know that high yield is a classic area to pay attention to, and we're up now to 500 basis points spread over treasuries, and it is still trending higher. On a total return basis, the high yield sector is up around 10%, and there are plenty of bonds yielding 12%. But people aren't buying them because they were probably 10% a week ago. So certainly there's going to be big opportunities in high yield debt, because not every company is going to go bust, but some companies will inevitably go bust. The complacency that we have in the market now is that during the pandemic, governments intervened and would not allow companies to go bust. So the belief is that that will continue to be the case, but it's a very difficult thing to justify when we know that one of the big factors in inflation was this willingness to take risks and to go out and spend with no regard for the future, because everyone believes now that the government is going to step in and support every asset price. And maybe they are. Maybe we'll just see an uptick in unemployment, and then governments will panic, and central banks will panic, and interest rates will come back down. And if that's the case, well, then asset prices are going to leap higher. But I'm very much in the show me camp. I want to see evidence of more liquidity being made available. And until then, I think the best place to be is in cash. Now, that's going to sound like anathema to most people, because they see that inflation is running at 8 and 9 and 10%. And how could you possibly say that the best place to be is in cash? But if whatever you're invested in goes down by 10% over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, well, then you've lost on inflation, you've lost on asset prices too. And cash, at least, has a yield these days. So what we're actually seeing in the market today is the re-imposition of a discount rate, and the hurdle over which every asset now has to get is the prevailing interest rate on deposits, or the prevailing interest rate on the 12-month yield. And US 12-month yields are 4%. People haven't had a 4% deposit or a fixed-term deposit in the USA for what must feel like forever. And you have to go back to 2001. That means that there's an entire generation of people, basically anyone under the age of 40, who's been working, has never been able to put money away for a year and make 4%. So that's something that is a massive hurdle for equities to jump over. And of course, because asset prices are high, it means there's a susceptibility to the risk of a rapid unwinding of valuations. And I created this chart just out of interest to highlight the commonality that we have between 2022 and 2008. Prices are just starting to deteriorate now, but in 2008, it was around this time that we had this huge acceleration. I'm not predicting that it's going to be exactly the same, but I am predicting that something's going to break. Now, it might not be the repo market this time, because the Federal Reserve has a standing repo facility. And it might not be the banks, or at least it's unlikely to be the U.S. banks, because they're better capitalized on this occasion. Then let's think about what were the companies that did best. Who did best from low interest rates and hugely available money? We have companies like Bread Financial. And these companies, they prospered from demand for credit in all these different stores, all these store cards. And the share has been trending down since 2015, and it's still trending down. Then we have airlines. They're still trending down, and they're going to need bailouts. That's Anglo-American. American Airlines, for example, is breaking down and approaching the 2020 lows again. When we think about private equity, I found it especially interesting over the last few years that at first, the number of people I know who have been in private equity and done very well for themselves has proliferated. I remember I had a roommate when I first moved to, a flatmate when I first moved to the UK, who was from Canada, and his best friend was involved in private equity. And in the firm he was in, it was expected that the profit you made from one deal would get reinvested in the next. So he made some money from his first deal, and he made some money in his second deal. So he now had, we were only like 24 at the time, and he had several hundred thousand dollars that he was investing in the third deal. And he was anticipating being a millionaire by the time he was 26. But of course, this was in the early 2000s. Interest rates were still high, and we were heading into a big recession after the 9/11 attacks, and his third venture went bust. But over the course of the last 15 years, nobody has gone bust in private equity. Money has been for free. Asset values have done nothing but rise. And companies like Brookfield Asset Management are referred to in reverential terms by investors because they've done so well. They were able to wade in 2008 and buy lots of properties. They were able to buy some of the choicest renewable energy ventures when they went bankrupt in 2011 and 12, and that forms now Brookfield Renewable Partners. They've been able to deploy financial engineering. So I think that when we look back on this phase in the economy, what we're actually going to be referring to it as is the financial engineering bubble. Because these companies have created layers of separation between themselves and the entities they've invested in, and between themselves and their investors. And the investors in these private equity ventures are primarily pension funds who have been starved for yield for over a decade. And now the whole question of mark to market is going to become a lot more relevant as interest rates begin to rise and fanciful valuations become tested. So I think that's coming. But the more important thing is that it pulled back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and now it's pulling back once more. We've seen this exact same kind of business model deployed in lots of different portions of the market. Danaher is another example. It's really been one of the most successful of the listed private equity type business models, but it's also pulling back from its most recent test of the $300 level. Roper Technologies is actually a dividend aristocrat, and it's now breaking downwards. And it's also deployed this private equity model to buy smaller companies and put management control over them and grow them into bigger businesses. And that kind of business model does fantastically well in a low interest rate environment and not great in a higher interest rate environment because it suddenly introduces time as a limiting factor. And time matters when you're trying to grow a business. So my conclusion here is that we're definitely seeing money getting siphoned out of various asset classes. Oil and copper have been weak, and gold broke downwards in here today. So it's been distributing below $1,700 for the last week, and now it's breaking back down below the 1,000-day moving average. So this is not looking like favorable trading activity. There's the potential that it's going to go lower from here. In a worst case scenario, it could get down to $1,500. The big challenge here is that central banks are raising rates. We might still have negative real interest rates, but they're not nearly as negative as they were before. And the dollar is exceptionally strong, and that is sapping demand for gold. But the dollar is not going to be strong indefinitely. And when it rolls over, then commodities are going to stage a significant recovery. When we think about what are the kinds of things that should do well in the future, well, obviously geopolitics are going to play a role, and that's very hard to predict. But the promises that have been made in this bull market, they will come true. We are going to have a big data revolution. There are going to be major innovations made in the technology sector, like healthcare. And at some stage, we might even have autonomous vehicles. I'm very reluctant to think that we're going to have, or we're all going to have, electric vehicles in the timeline that investors believe is possible. But we might have it in double the timeline, the timeline. I believe that there's going to be a sea change in how people view infrastructure development. And I've seen enough of evidence now that global climate change is happening. I don't see as much convincing evidence to support the argument that we can do anything about it. And since that's the case, there's going to be a lot of necessary investment in infrastructure to deal with drought, flood, storms, and storm surge. And that's going to represent a massive draw on commodity demand, quite apart from anything else that happens. But we're going to see a significant unwinding of asset price appreciation over the next while. And I don't believe that central banks are really going to stop raising rates until they do break something. And the way asset prices are going now, well, we're a lot closer to seeing something break than we were at the beginning of this year. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.